what it was in the program, a lot of the same words. I decided sufficient statistics and pooling were more refined topics, and it might be better if I kept my talk to more general topics like conditional independence and Markov chains. I should say that much of what I'm going to talk about is joint work with Matt Leifer, and there's also some preliminary results of joint work with Bob Koeke. And this is very much work in progress, so that there are probably mistakes here. We haven't thought everything through clearly, and I've made the very foolish mistake of trying to talk a bit about categories, and I know very little about categories. I just started learning it last week from Bob, so please go easy on me. if you find my mistakes, point them out. But maybe you should just think of them as pictures. Anyhow, an alternative way to think about this talk is I'm going to try to provide evidence that quantum theory should be thought of as a non-commutative generalization of classical probability theory. So it strikes me that the picture calculus that we've been seeing so much of does not make it clear a priori exactly how to interpret these boxes and these triangles. Should these be thought of as preparations of physical states and physical transformations, or is it more appropriate to think of them as a kind of probability theory? And so I'm going to try to argue in this talk that there are good reasons to think of it as a kind of probability theory. Okay, so here's my motivating slide. Consider the following analogy. So if you want to claim that quantum theory is a probability theory, then you might expect that density operators ought to be interpreted like probability distributions. So the analogy is pretty good. Instead of random variables, which you have in the classical case, you have Hilbert spaces, which will be labeled by A and B, which should be thought of, again, as types of systems, given dimensionality. And you have probability distributions over random variables. In quantum mechanics, you have density operators, which are positive operators on the Hilbert space, rather than positive functions on the set of values that that variable can pick on. You have a normalization condition on your probability distributions, as so, and you have a trace one condition on your density operators, so that's sort of analogous. You have joint probability distributions in the classical case, which, when you sum over both random variables, are normalized, and you have joint density operators in the quantum case on tensor products of Hilbert spaces, rather than Cartesian products of state spaces, and you have a trace condition on the density operators. The marginals are obtained by marginalization of just one of the variables. If you trace out just one of the systems, you get a marginal or reduced density operator. So all of this seems pretty analogous. But then there's this glaring absence on the quantum realm of anything analogous to conditional probability. And conditional probabilities are, of course, critical for classical probability theory. If you want to do any sort of Bayesian inference problem, you need conditional probabilities. And these are defined, of course, as joint probability divided by the marginal. They're also positive functions on the Cartesian product of the value spaces for the two random variables. And they're defined, so if I look at the conditional probability of A given B, they're defined for values of B such that the probability of B is non-zero. And if I sum over the values of A, I'll get a normalized probability distribution. So that should be familiar. And the question is there anything analogous quantum mechanically? Yes?
So yes. Capital A and B, a random variable usually means a measurable function on a Borel space. But you now actually mean that there are events in writing P of A. Are they subsets of a measure space, or what are they?
I'm thinking of just a finite set, so it's a discrete variable. I suppose I could generalize it to a measure space if I wanted to.
Yeah, but even in the finite set, a random variable is usually a function of something.
I think when he writes P of A, he means P of A equals little a or something.
That's right, yeah. So this is sort of a convention that's used in information theory, at least. Uh-huh. Where, you know, when I write P of A, I mean the set of all the values, P A equals little a. And little a takes its values in some set, script A. this won't really be critical for what's to come. So the question is, can we do anything analogous in quantum? So I'm going to tell you about some work that Matt Liefer did to introduce a notion of a conditional density operator. So here's, I just reposted the definition of conditional probability. And now the question is, can we come up with something analogous for quantum? Well, you might think we have an analog for the joint distribution, we have an analog for the marginal, but we need to invert the marginal. So you might say, well, let's just take the inverse of the marginal on B and identity on A and multiply rho and B with that. That's a first guess. So there's a problem with this. First of all, the marginal on B needn't have an inverse because it could have zero eigenvalues. That's easily solved. Just take this to be the pseudo-inverse instead. So it's the inverse of the density operator on the region of Hilbert space where rho B has support. And so, you know, rho B is just has a spectral resolution. So this is its pseudo-inverse. I'll just call it the inverse from now on. And of course, if I multiply the inverse with the density operator, I just get identity from the support of rho B. So that's fine. But there's another problem, which is that the joint density operator need not commute with identity across the inverse marginal on B. And so, in general, this thing that I've defined up there isn't positive. So a nice solution to that problem is just to use a symmetric expression. So take the square root of this thing, multiply on the left and the right by the square root. And now I'm going to use, throughout the talk, a notational convention, which will simplify equations, which is to drop the identity and to drop the tensor product and just write my conditional density operator as follows. So whenever you see an expression like this, it really means implicitly an operator on A tensor B multiplying rho AB. But this is a nice notation because it's so reminiscent of the classical expression. You just say, instead of dividing by the marginal, I distort by the inverse of the marginal. This process of putting a square root on both sides was called distortion in a paper by Houston, Years, and Wooters. I kind of like that name. So that's going to be the definition of the conditional density operator.
It has properties analogous to the conditional probability. If I take the analog of the marginal over A, so I just trace over A, well, the trace comes through rho B, just traces rho AB. The trace of rho AB is just rho B, and now I multiply by the inverse, and I just get identity on the support of rho B, which is analogous to what I have here, which is this is one and only well-defined when the probability of B taking the value little b is not zero. Yeah, so this, the fact that it's just on the support of rho b is analogous to that fact. So you can, this conditional density operator was introduced in this paper by Matt. Questions about that? Okay, so now I have I filled the blank over on the right-hand side. What I'm going to take to be analogous to these conditional probabilities are the conditional density operators. I should also mention that if you ask it, what sort of object is this, it's a positive operator on the Hilbert space A tensor B. Okay. Let me give you an example just to give you some familiarity with this new concept. Suppose I take a pure state over two systems. So I can always write it according to its Schmidt decomposition, where these are orthogonal bases for A and B, and I can absorb any phases into one of these bases. So I'll just write root of the probabilities for the amplitudes. And if I calculate the density operator for that, I get this expression. And now I can start calculating the marginals. So let me calculate the marginal for B. I get just the sum over K, PK projectors onto the VK. And this, of course, is the inverse square root. So now I can use the inverse square root to distort rho AB, that's this expression, and calculate the conditional density operator. And what I find is that it basically eliminates the off-diagonal terms, and these two square roots on the bottom will cancel with these coefficients, and I'll get just unit coefficients. And so I can write this new density operator just as it's just this pure state here. It's the density operator for this pure state, which is the same as the pure state I started with, except without the coefficients. And so essentially, if you ask, well, where's the information that was inside AB, the original state, you find the conditional density operator encodes the relationship between the Schmidt bases of A and B, these bases here. That's all that this state encodes. So it's like it has the same information as a unitary that would take me from one basis to the other. Whereas the marginal encodes the actual Schmidt bases of B and the relative amplitudes of the different terms. So I've basically split the information in the density operator into two pieces, one which describes the relation between the two systems and the other which describes the information about one of the systems, much as I could factorize a joint probability into a conditional probability and a marginal. But of course, I can calculate the conditional density operator for more than pure states. Okay, so now I'm going to start using it to make some observations about the sense in which quantum probability theory is different from classical probability theory. So the first observations I want to make have to do with correlations and causal structure. So I want to note something about classical probability theory, namely that it's essentially blind to causal structure in the following sense. If I have two events, A and B, that are perhaps events pertaining to independent systems or events at space-like separated locations, and if I know the conditional probability of B given A, and then I learn something about A, which is represented in the form of an updated probability distribution for A, then I can update my probability distribution for B by this formula. And if, instead of having two events that are space-like separated, I have two events that are time-like separated, and I have the same scenario, I know something about the conditional probability, and then I learn something about A, I update my knowledge of B in precisely the same way. The calculus is exactly the same, regardless of whether these things are space-like or time-like separated. And that doesn't seem to be the case for quantum theory. So now, the analogous thing to knowing a conditional probability would be to know a conditional density operator relating B to A. So B and A are now quantum systems. And suppose I learn something about A, and I capture that knowledge by an updated density operator for A. So one way this could happen is that I originally have some bipartite state for AB, of which I know only the relationship between the two systems, and then I learn something about A by perhaps doing a measurement on it. In that case, I can update rho B to be just trace over A of the joint density operator, rho AB, but from the last slide, the joint density operator is the rho A distorted version of the conditional density operator. Let me just go back a slide and see that. If I want to just solve for rho AB in this equation, I have to distort by now the positive square root on both sides. So rho AB will be rho B to the 1/2, rho A given B, rho B to the 1/2. And then when I trace over B, I can use the cyclic property of the trace and just accumulate the rho A's in one spot. So that looks very much analogous to the equation I would use classically to update my information about the system B. But now you say, well, what if those two events are separated in time? Maybe they're the same system after some transformation has been applied to them. So again, I know something about the relationship between the two systems. I know the nature of this transformation. So this is a trace-preserving, completely positive map. And then I learn something about A, which is represented in the form of a density operator. So perhaps I do a preparation on A. And the question is, how should I update my knowledge of B? The answer is just apply the completely positive map to rho A, which looks very different from this description here. And so it might seem that, quantum theory is not a probability theory because you might have expected probability theory to have this sort of feature, that it doesn't matter whether you're making inferences this way or this way, the calculus will look the same. But it turns out that you can, it can be made to look essentially the same. And so let me argue for that. First, note that there's another way I could write the classical update rule, which is by thinking about a map which now acts on the space of probability distributions over A. So summing over A and multiplying by the conditional probability, all of that procedure can be thought of as a single map acting on possible probability distributions over A. Of course, it's the same whether you do it space-like or time-like. And so this equation could just be thought of as similar to this form. And the question is, well, why in the time-like case don't I have an equation of this form, and why in the space-like case don't I have an equation of this form? And the answer is you do. So what I'm going to show you is that actually you can write the update rule here in the time-like case as something almost entirely analogous to the classical one. It's going to be multiply the marginal on A with the conditional density operator B given A and trace over A. But the small difference is that I need a transpose over A here. And similarly, I can also write this as a CP map acting on row A, but I also need that extra transpose. So what comes out is that quantum probability theory does have essentially analogous representations for how to update your knowledge across space or across time, but there is a difference. And so it's not completely blind to the causal structure, as classical probability theory is. Yes? Yes, and in fact, yeah. Yes. So, and when I present the pictorial calculus, it'll be clear that, you know, if the objects are invariant under transpose, then you get the classical case. So you could, it's certainly amenable to thinking of classical probability theory as a special case of this. Yeah.
Like in the time-like procedure, it's called traversal and separates Bayesians and anti-Bayesians. This is the Bayesian stance you take, isn't it, on the bottom side? So your time-like update rule is not a triviality.
What's controversial?
Doing this, that you use exactly the same formalism as in the space-like case for the time-like updating. Aren't there whole books about and against and in favor of this procedure?
I'm not familiar with that literature. What is the argument? I mean, how else would you update your probabilities across time if not like this?
Well, there's no controversy about that. There's the controversy among statisticians of being a Bayesian or not. That has nothing to do with it.
I think the time update that you write is the Bayesian procedure. Well, the identification is non-trivial, I think, and sort of obscure.
Statistics is whether statistics should be about updating probabilities or not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it is about updating probabilities. I don't think that they would argue that this is a good idea.
No, I think this is the right way of phrasing it, but it's a non-trivial step.
So maybe not the. The fact that these are the same is not untrue.
But the fact that you can
update your probabilities as this might be not true. Although my impression is that something so basic as this is not really a bone of contention between Bayesians and statisticians. But I'm willing to be convinced otherwise. All right, so let me try to convince you that I can write the update rule in this alternative form. So basically, I'm trying to convince you of this theorem, that there is a map, which does a time-like update can be written in that form. So to do that, I need to remind you of the Choi-Jamolkowski isomorphism, but in a slightly non-standard form. So often, the Choi-Jamolkowski isomorphism is expressed as an isomorphism between trace non-increasing maps and density operators on a pair of systems. And it turns out, if you want to focus your attention on trace-preserving completely positive maps, then the isomorphic set of entities on a bipartite system are the conditional density operators, which I've just introduced. So the argument is as follows. If you apply your map, so this notation, incidentally, I didn't mention it, just means
This is a map from the Hilbert space of A to the Hilbert space of B. If I apply this map on half of a maximally entangled state, then, you know, and here's the tutorial diagram for that. I'm not going to say much about the category theory, so I'm sort of going to assume the people in the audience who know what all this means can might be happy with these equations, and for the rest of you, I'm going to be providing explicit expressions. Maybe just a few words. The diagrams I'm going to be writing down in this talk strictly belong to the category of CPM, which Peter Selinger has written about and Bob Kuka has been teaching me about. So boxes will be completely positive maps, and triangles are going to be represent density operators. Okay, so if I apply my map to half of a maximally entangled state, what I get out is a bipartite quantum state, which is completely mixed on the A side, because the maximally entangled state was completely mixed, and applying a map on this side doesn't change that fact. And so if I just multiply by a scalar, I get a conditional density operator, which is something which, if I trace on the B side, I get identity on the A system. So the only difference between this and a bipartite state that was completely mixed on the B side is a factor of D. So I can just multiply and set this equal to the conditional density operator. So that I represent by this diagram here. And then if I want to recover the map from the conditional density operator, I do what the quantum information theorists call gate teleportation. You can think of it as preparing a system with this conditional density operator, doing a maximally entangled state measurement, or post-selecting on getting a maximally entangled state here. And then effectively, your quantum information flows through this density operator, and it has the effect of implementing that map. We've seen this before. Okay, so that's a slightly different version of Choi-Jelmakowski. Again, this is in Matt Leifer's original paper on the conditional density operator. Let me now use that to prove this theorem. So I just write down the expression for the Choi-Jelmakowski isomorphic map to, this should be a conditional state, B given A prime. Actually, scratch this whole line, that's fine, forget that. I can just write it down as follows. And then I express the maximally entangled state. Here it is. I take the A prime terms acting on this guy, and the A terms act on this guy. So I have a term like this, and a term like this. And I have to now, I start out with J on the left and J prime on the right, and I need a transpose to get J prime on the left and J on the right. Once I've done that, if I sum over J prime, I just have identity here, and the other sum over J gives me a trace. And so with that partial trace, I manage to get it into this form. Yes?
So when you state this theorem, is it really for any map epsilon B slash or A, there exists a row B slash A?
Yeah, so or maybe more precisely, I should say, if you go and find the Choi-Jelmakowski isomorphic state, mm-hmm. conditional density operator, mm-hmm. to that map, mm-hmm. then you can express the action of that map as the trace with that conditional density operator partially transposed. Okay. So what's implicit here is the fact that this is isomorphic to that.
And so that will not necessarily be a positive operator that will be after you do the partial transpose.
After the partial transpose, it's not necessarily a positive operator, that's true.
So there's even a little more complicated the theorem, which is how you get row B given A.
How you...
Yeah, I mean, there's a construction, there's a recipe.
Right.
You know, there.
Right. So diagrammatically, what this means is, or the proof of this, I should say, is that if I just take this map and I plug in the diagram for how to express that map in terms of its Choi-Jelmakowski isomorphic state, I just need to plug this in, and that gives me this, right? So that's the diagram, just plugs in here. And it turns out you can prove that in this sort of setting, this connection can be represented as tracing after having taken the partial transpose. Okay. So now what's the oh yes, Kuka.
The time-like case, what is the joint system?
What is the joint?
Yeah, system A and B. Because it's the same system as the voltage and for cell measurement.
Well, what this basically allows you to do is to think of two times, even though it may be the same system, as a tensor product of a Hilbert space for the system at this time and a Hilbert space for the system at that time. So it's a way of representing temporal differences by tensor products.
Another question. This conditional density operator, am I supposed to use it in the normal way, like picking a trace together with a P of M element and things like that, or it's just a normal density operator in a way? Or?
Well, I'm going to give some examples of how to use it. The theorem I just showed is one example, right? So if I want to figure out how a density operator gets updated under a CP map, and I tell you what the conditional density operator associated with that CP map is, and you ask, well, how do I use it to calculate how things are going to change? The answer is just use this formula.
It is like a Born rule, not quite, but it's what's that?
Think of it as like classical probability theory. The prescription is take your conditional probability, multiply it by your P of A, your starting probability, sum over A. Just keep that in mind. That's the new prescription for how you should do quantum updating. Take your conditional density operator, multiply it by the density operator you start with, trace over A. The only difference is you've got to make sure you take that transpose. Okay, so it's a very intuitive algorithm because we use it all the time in classical probability theory. Okay, so what's the significance of this partial transpose? The significance is that you actually find in quantum theory differences between the kinds of correlations you can have across space and the kinds of correlations you can have across time. So if I have some conditional density operator and I have an effect, a measurement on each of the systems, and let me just call these effects little a and little b, I can ask, does that correlation, so suppose this happens with probability 1, does that same correlation happen here with probability 1? If I pre-select on little a and post-select on little b, can I find that with probability 1 I have success in that post-selection? That would be an instance where space-like correlations were the same as time-like correlations. And if you replace this conditional density operator through the Choi-Jelinkowski isomorphism with a map acting on half a maximum entangled state, and I bend this down, by bending this down I have to take the transpose of this effect, I see that these are not quite the same, right? There's a difference in the preparation. This is the transpose of little a, where this is little a. And so for some states, the transpose does nothing, and I get the same sorts of correlations. But for other states, the state will change. So for example, if I consider Pauli spin operators, then the identity map, for example, gives me perfect correlation between the x spin of a pre-selection and a post-selection, and perfect correlation for the y-spin, and perfect correlation for the z-spin. All three of them, if I do nothing, you'll find exactly the same results. But if I prepare a joint quantum state and I do a measurement of x, x, or y, y, or z, z, what I'll find is that x and z are correlated, but y is anti-correlated. And ultimately, that's because when I take the transpose of the y eigenstates, they flip from plus to minus. And so it's only, so if I have a plus y, that's correlated with a minus y here and here. So that is the difference. Ultimately, I think it boils down to, I think you can make sense of this if you imagine that quantum theory is a theory of probability where there's a restriction on how much you can know, because effectively, to use another example, if you have position and momentum, identity gives you correlation of position and momentum, but we know that there's no quantum state that's a joint eigenstate of x1 minus x2 and p1 minus p2. So the fact that the difference in position and the difference in momentum are not commuting quantities is what tells you that you need to have a different kind of correlation across space than what you can have across time. Now, follow up on Howard's comment earlier. Given that classical probability distributions can be represented as diagonal density operators, and those are invariant under transpose,
it's clear that this difference doesn't appear in classical probability theory because all your probability distributions are invariant under this transpose operation. So you get the same correlations here as you do here. Okay, so let me move on now to the topic of Bayesian inversion, or Bayes' theorem. So we're all familiar with the classical Bayes' theorem. If I want to know what the probability of B given A is, given the probability of A given B, I have to multiply by the probability of B and divide by the probability of A. And the proof is simply that, you know, by definition, the probability of A given B is just the joint over the marginal on B. So I can rewrite it that in this form. But I can also rewrite it in this form, and I set these guys equal, and I get that equation. So I can do precisely the analogous thing with conditional density operators and get a quantum analog of Bayes' theorem. So here it is. If I have the conditional density operator for A given B, and I want to find the conditional density operator for B given A, I multiply by rho B, i.e. distort by the square root of rho B, and then I divide by rho A, distort by the inverse of rho A. And the proof is just, again, by definition, rho A given B is the inverse distorted joint, so the one where I have rho B's to the minus a half on the left. And I can take those over to be a positive distortion on the right, but I could also express the joint as a positive distortion of rho B given A. And so setting these two equal and rearranging, I get that equation. And remembering that each of these represents rho A tensor identity on B, and this is rho B tensor identity on A, it's clear that rho A and rho B commute, and so it actually doesn't matter what order I put these distortions in. So how do I represent this sort of thing diagrammatically? And this is much of what I've been working with Bob on recently. So first of all, let me introduce some new notation. This distortion map is a completely positive map, and so I can represent it by a box, and I'll just put rho A in the box. So whenever you see this, it just means that map. These conditional density operators are bipartite states, and so this equation can be written as take the bipartite state for rho A given B, distort on B by rho B, distort by the inverse of rho A on A, and you'll get the conditional of B given A. And now if I use the Choi-Jelinkowski isomorphism and turn this into a map acting on a maximal entangled state, and similarly for this guy, this is the map that acts takes B to A. This is the map that takes A to B. I'll get this equation, and so I can just determine then what just the map from A to B looks like, and it's this form here. So I just have to bring this down. If I bring it down on both sides, then I straighten this. And so you see that it's like a compact structure, except that in order to invert this guy, right, from A to B to B to A, I need to add a cap and a cup, which are, as Bob says, decorated by these extra boxes, these distortions. So you could, if you wanted to, define a cap, a new cap in terms which includes this distortion and a new cup that includes this distortion, and just think of this as a yanking rule where you just slide this guy, and as he turns upside down, I need to reinterpret him as the conditional map that goes in the other direction. So I suspect that this will make calculations easier than doing out the algebra using this formula. But I should also say that when I set out to solve problems with this formalism, I find that this formula is actually really useful because I can always think, well, what would the classical formula look like? I'm looking for the probability of A, B given C, D, E, and I start with this thing, and I immediately start doing my classical Bayesian inversions, and I sort of know how to play that game. And I can just play the analogous game here. So far, I haven't yet become sort of good at doing calculations using the diagram. Diagrammatic calculus. I presume that comes with time. Okay, let me talk a bit about conditional independence now. Well, first, any questions about Bayesian inversion? Yes.
You invert the time ordering of A and B in order to define B given A in respect of A given B.
Yes?
In classical probability theory, you don't need to do that, because if I give you information about a given time,
yes,
you can update your knowledge at that preceding time with no problem.
So I think you should not interpret up here as meaning a temporal direction, but meaning a direction of inference, givens and derived. So in this sort of graphical calculus, you can bend things around, and you can therefore start imagining, writing this, well, just what I said, you know, not to mean that this necessarily comes before B.
So I could use that conditional operator to derive information about the density matrix at a preceding time.
Yes.
Okay.
And in fact, if I get to it, I'll show you a time-reversed version of Born rule that you can derive from this thing. But yeah, that's exactly what you would want to be able to do, talk about estimation in arbitrary directions and space or time. And of course, bearing in mind that there is this partial transpose you always have to keep track of. That's the one subtlety. It would have been nice if it was exactly like classical probability theory and you never had to worry about that. But unfortunately, we do. All right, so conditional independence. Classically, we say that two systems or events, A and C, are conditionally independent given B if the probability of AC given B factorizes into the probability of A given B and the probability of C given B. It turns out it's equivalent to write that as the probability of A given B, C being equal to the probability of A given B alone. And similarly with A and C reversed. This is often described as B screening off A from C. So all the correlations between A and C are mediated by B. That's conditional independence. And it turns out you can define an analogous notion for conditional density operators. So A and C are conditionally independent given B if the conditional density operator AC given B can be factorized. And it turns out that if it can be factorized, it implies that these two density operators actually commute. But it can also be written in the following way. Rho A given BC is just rho A given B tensor the identity on the support of rho C. So this is a very useful concept when you're doing Bayesian inference. Typically, you have so many, if you really had a joint probability distribution over n systems, it would have exponential and n number of parameters and you couldn't really do any work. It's the fact that you have conditional independencies that makes inference problems tractable. And so this is a key concept. And it's good to have an analog in the quantum case. David Poulain and Matt Liefer have worked on belief propagation algorithms in the quantum realm, where this notion of conditional independence is critical. Let me just say one quick word about how to represent this diagrammatically. So Bob and I have been struggling with this. It turns out you need to introduce a new element, something that is not in CPM. You can define this in the underlying category if you want, but it doesn't exist naturally in CPM. And you can essentially think of this new element as matrix multiplication. So this sort of equation can be thought of as the conditional density operator of AC given B is basically the matrix multiplication of the B arms of these two conditional density operators. And if I use the Troy-Yamakowski isomorphism and rewrite this as a map from B to AC, it turns out that what that conditional independence states that I can rewrite that as sort of a splitting operation followed by the maps on the individual sides. And so I'm not going to go into the detail of how to define this thing, but what excites me about this is the fact that you now have something that looks a lot like the graphical models people use to analyze Bayesian networks. So you may have seen things like this. If A and C are conditionally independent given B, you can write down a network with arrows of this form. And so it would be really nice if you could make a connection between the category theory and this huge body of work on graphical models of Bayesian networks. And it seems to me that this approach is moving in that direction. I should also note that if you restrict yourself to classical cases, then this just becomes a Frobenius structure. Okay, so there's not a lot of time left. I don't know exactly which topics I should cover. Let me say a little bit about Markov chains. So suppose that you have, I'm not going to say anything about general Markov chains, but suppose you just now have three random variables, A, B, and C, and you're interested in finding the probability of A given C. Well, you can just
you know, write it down as the probability of AB given C marginalizing over B. You can have an expression for this in terms of row ABC. Here's the most general expression for row ABC. And if you plug that in, you just get this. That's just standard probability calculus. And now if A and C are conditionally independent given B, then this term here has no dependence on C. And so I can plug that back in and I get this equation. So this is the kind of equation you use to calculate conditional probabilities when you have conditional independence. So this is a Markov chain C, B, A. So that is possibly familiar to some of you. And you can do exactly the same thing in the quantum case. So you start with a joint density operator on A, B, C. You want to calculate row A given C. So you run through the calculus. Everywhere you have multiplication and division over here, you just have distortion. And at the end of the day, if you use the conditional independence, you get precisely the analogous expression to this one. Whether you have transposes here or not depends on whether A, B, and C are space-like or time-like separated. So I haven't here I've assumed that A, B, and C are all just space-like separated. But if I have more of these things, I could have an arbitrary kind of structure. And I need to keep track of all that when I write down this equation. So, Luca, this sort of answers your question. You know, here's another use of the conditional density operator. It allows you to start inferring A given C from things like A given B and B given C. And so, you know, there's many applications. You know, very simple, if you want to know what is the effective map given two maps in composition, then what you can show is that that problem, in terms of conditional density operators, just reduces to taking this combination of the individual conditionals with the partial transpose here. So diagrammatically, I just replace this map with the conditional, and that's equal to this, which is equal to that. I can replace the conditionals in here, and I sort of straighten this out, and what I find is that this guy is just this, and this cup here is means the trace over B taking the transpose. So that's one place where it comes in handy. You can also do the Born rule in this sort of way. So if you have a preparation followed by a measurement, really all that is a map from a classical system to a quantum, and then another map from a quantum to a classical. And this is another example of A and C being conditionally independent given B. All the information about C is mediated through B. It was the same with the composition of the maps. And so again, I can use this Markov chain formalism. And so if I want to know what's the conditional density operator for the whole creature, right? So this is just going to give me the probabilities of values A bar given C bar. Then I set this thing equal to the whole thing. I replace conditional density operators for each of them. I straighten it out. And again, I get the same form. So I can always write the Born rule in this way. This thing here, classical to quantum, is a set of preparations. This thing here, quantum to classical with a partial transpose, is a set of effects, a POVM. And it's just a unified formalism for writing that all down. So I'm out of time, but Luca, if you want to do retrodiction, all you have to do is invert and ask what's the conditional density operator for C bar given A bar. You can do all the math, and you get something that basically looks like you're preparing a state from the future into the past, and then you're doing a measurement. So you just look at the time reversal of the same scenario. And you can use the cups and the caps that I introduced, do the Bayesian inversion diagrammatically, and you get the right result. So I should probably skip this. You can also talk about tripartite states, which have conditional independence between two systems given the third. And then there's a number of other topics that you can re-examine using this. We have some new results, Matt and I, on the pooling problem. I think in the future, it would be nice to develop a graphical calculus for Bayesian inference generally and see if it has connections to the graphical models of Bayesian networks. And thanks for your attention. I'll stop there.
Sort of a question for you. that relates to some work Manny and I did a while back. I don't think
which paper?
So,
oh yeah, probably the one on error correction.
Yeah, so it's the one on this near optimal reversal operation. And what you what the Krauss operators are for that is so you end up row distorting the output density matrix, or row inverse distorting it.
Yes.
And then you hit it with the dagger of the Krauss operator from the noise thing, and then you row distort by the input matrix.
Yeah.
So it's except that having these Krauss operators in there, it's kind of like
it's.
So is there any way to?
So that probably should have been on this list. So Robin Blumkahoot and Steve Bartlett and I have a project, ongoing project, which loosely speaking is, you know, the title, the working title is error, quantum error correction as quantum Bayesian inversion or statistical inference. So you can think of this as a way of undoing errors, right? So you've applied some error map, B given A. Now you want to apply some new map, A given B, that undoes the error. So you can try as a candidate just the you know, Bayesian inversion of B given A. And what you get when you do that, at least for unital error maps, is precisely the near optimal correction scheme that is in your paper with Manny Carroll.
But only for unital.
It could be more general than that. I'm only confident that it works for a unital one.
Okay. Rob, is there some connection between what you've done and the original many, many years ago? I'm fired off the Lovitz and somebody else.
Yeah.
Kind of a time symmetric formulation of measurement processes.
Yeah, very good. So that's item number two here, pre and post selection. So certainly I think if you're interested in making inferences about, say, the outcomes of a measurement in between a preparation and a future measurement, and this sort, that's exactly the kind of thing that you can do in classical probability theory. And this sort of formalism is ideally suited to it. And so what I anticipate is that I can re-derive, I mean, it's all just quantum mechanics, so I should be able to re-derive not just those old results, but there's some very exciting new results. I think Popescu is also an author, Aronov, Popescu, a few others, on, you know, entanglement across time and taking into account the case you could have an entangled preparation, an entangled measurement, and a measurement here. I think this will be a very nice formalism for taking all that stuff and many other things and sort of giving it a unified language for describing it all and intuitions about how you ought to do it, given your intuitions about how to make inferences classically.
Okay, let's thank you all for doing that.